Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 21, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society Practice Group's telephone conference call on labor unions and domestic workers. My name is Dean Reuter, and I'm Director and Vice President of the Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and we're recording today's call for possible use as a podcast. Today, we're happy to welcome to our call Andrew Grossman of the Baker & Hostetler firm right here in Washington, D.C. His complete bio was provided to you in the notice of today's call. It's also available on our website, so I'm going to be very short with my introductions. In fact, I'll say no more to preserve time for his presentation. And with that, we're going to hear some opening remarks from Mr. Grossman, but as always, we'll be looking to you, the audience members, for your questions at the conclusion of his opening remarks, which I think will be about 5 to 10 minutes or so. Mr. Grossman, please go right ahead.
Thank you. We'll begin with a brief summary of the case and how it got here, and then discuss today's oral arguments. The case was Harris v. Quinn, and really, it may be the sleeper case of the term, one that come June we all recognize to be a landmark decision. And I really think that's the upside of today's oral arguments. Now, Harris works on two levels. One is narrow, one's broad. In a narrow sense, Harris is a challenge to a practice that dates back just about a decade, where national unions, typically the SEIU or the AFSCME, push state officials to name the state as employer of record for home-based workers. This makes those workers subject to unionization, just like any other state employees. Usually the state's connection with these workers is that they receive subsidies, things like providing daycare, childcare, or home-based health services to the disabled or to low-income individuals. Now, this case concerns home care providers, many of them serving family members who are seriously disabled, and they receive a small stipend from the state to offset the burden of care. The state, Illinois, in turn, avoids having to pay to institutionalize these patients. In 2003, Illinois decided to recognize home care workers receiving subsidies through its rehabilitation program as state employees, but only for the purpose of collective bargaining. The law is actually quite clear that they are not considered state employees for any other purposes, such as state worker benefits or subjecting the state to vicarious liability. The law is also clear that the state is not responsible for hiring, firing, or supervising these workers, but controlling the facilities in which they work, which are, after all, often the workers' own homes, or even for evaluating their performance. Those things are all done either by the recipients of home care, that is the patients, or by their guardians. The state recognized the SEIU, a labor union, as these workers' exclusive representative. And so now they have to pay the union to bargain with the state over the very narrow range of things that the state actually controls, basically just the wages. Even workers who choose not to join the union have to pay a fair share fee. Now, it was only in 1977, in a case called Abood v. Detroit Board of Education, that the Supreme Court addressed whether state governments may compel their workers to associate with and to support a labor union. The court held that they could, based on their interest in maintaining labor peace and subsidiary need to avoid free riders, that is, workers who receive the benefits of collective bargaining without paying for union representation. Now, labor peace is a term that dates back decades, the massive industrial strikes and labor violence of the early 20th century. The idea is that a business or a government can negotiate with a single labor union representing all of its employees, and that way it can avoid things like crippling strikes, having its factory burnt to the ground, and massive brawls between different between workers affiliated with competing unions. Abood never addressed anything like what we have in Harris, and that's the narrow issue. This concerns home-based workers who don't really have much to do with the state at all. The state's interest here in maintaining labor peace is, to say the very least, somewhat attenuated. The plaintiffs argue that in these circumstances, the state has no legitimate interest that overrides their rights to freedom of speech, freedom of association, and freedom to petition the government themselves with their grievances. If the Supreme Court agrees, that would be a major blow to organized labor because it would undercut a technique that unions have used to organize hundreds of thousands of workers in recent years. Any of those workers would then be free to decide whether or not to support the union. That would be a major win for First Amendment rights. But the plaintiffs also raise a broader issue based on a case from two terms ago called Knox. They asked the court to consider whether Abood itself was wrongly decided, and governments never have a sufficiently compelling interest to force their workers to support a labor union, and in particular, to support a labor union's speech on matters like public worker benefits and the size of government that are inherently political. As Knox recognized, the free rider rationale in labor law is somewhat of an anomaly, because free rider arguments don't allow the government to compel speech or association in just about any other situation. In other words, the government can usually achieve its goals even when there are free riders. Now, if this argument prevails, the upshot is that while a state or a government may want to work with the labor union, it couldn't force its workers to join or to pay to support that union. They would get to choose. The court, prior to our argument, nobody really knew which way the court would look at the case. This broader argument came relatively late in the case due to the lateness of the Knox decision. And so the question was, the first question of the day was, is the court going to be comfortable with recognizing the natural implications of its recent First Amendment decisions and reconsidering Abood? Well, we have an answer to that, and the answer is yes. If anything is clear following oral argument today, it's that Abood is in play. The court was very clear that it's willing and eager to go back to first principles. Does forcing public sector employees to pay money, that is fair share fees, to a labor union satisfy the strict scrutiny required by the First Amendment, particularly when the speech that they're paying for is something that they may disagree with? Now, the oral argument today began with some confusion. There was some ambiguity in the plaintiff's briefs as to whether or not they were challenging the exclusive representation clause of the labor agreement at issue. That's the clause that says that the state will only bargain with a particular union, or whether it was only challenging the compelled support of speech due to the fair share payments that dissenting workers have to pay. As to exclusive representation, the argument would be that a worker has an exclusive right for him or herself to petition the government with his grievances, including over things such as pay. But in this instance, it's pretty clear that these workers aren't being prevented or precluded from petitioning governments, but that they have the right to do so. The problem is that the labor union is also doing it on their behalf, even though they may disagree with its speech. So it was a question by Justice Scalia that really turned the argument around early on. He asked, I suppose the fact that you're entitled to speak about against abortion would not justify the government in requiring you to give money to Planned Parenthood. In other words, it's not the petitioning that's the matter here. It's the forced subsidization of the speech. And that quickly brought the argument around to the question of exacting scrutiny. In other words, the government must have a compelling interest if it's going to abridge its workers' First Amendment rights, particularly on issues of public concern. Now, until recently, the argument that the court has relied upon to justify holding an Abood and forcing workers to pay fair share payments were really embraced very heavily by Paul Smith, who was arguing for the state of Illinois, and by the Solicitor General, who argued supporting the state of Illinois and the labor union. Their view is that labor peace, avoiding free riders, and states' enormous reliance interest on Abood over the past almost 40 years all give states the authority and the need to help manage their workforce as a proprietary interest that they have. The problem is that while the court has recognized since Abood, that even these limited interests still do abridge First Amendment rights. And that's forced the court into a path of having to decide which types of expenditures are properly chargeable to workers and which aren't. It's proven to be a very difficult test. The court has concluded that items that relate directly to collective bargaining are things that can be charged to workers through their fair share fees. Things that relate to politics can't be. Now, of course, the labor unions, in many, many cases, argue that about everything is related to collective bargaining in some manner, because even things like lobbying the government and trying to introduce legislation and trying to lobby for particular pieces of legislation can redound to their workers' benefits, so those workers should have to pay. On the other side, dissenting workers often take the view that even direct collective bargaining on their behalf, things like pensions and wages and so on, don't necessarily represent their views. And so they're nonetheless being forced, even in these core collective bargaining areas, to support speech on which they with which they disagree. Now, the court, in Bill Messenger's argument, he was arguing on behalf of the plaintiffs here, the court began trying to suss out what is the state's compelling interest. And I think that's really what the court was grasping at for the entirety of this oral argument. In other words, why is the union's participation so essential to figure out for a state what it is that its workers actually want? And then on the other side, what are the actual issues? What are the subjects of this speech that's involved in collective bargaining? Are these things that workers have a core First Amendment right to engage in and to not engage in if they disagree with the union speech? Or are we talking about things that just relate to workplace conditions and things that really aren't necessarily of a public interest? Well, if you start on that side of the equation, what is the speech at nature? Justice Kennedy really took the lead in the argument. He came forward with he proposed a hypothetical. Let's say you're talking about a teacher's union, and let's say you're talking about things like classroom size, hours, the pay for teachers. All of these things, he said, really relate to the size of government. And this is a question, he said, quote, on which there are fundamental political beliefs, fundamental convictions that are being sacrificed if a non-union member objects to this line of policy. Justice Alito picked up on that point. He recognized that a younger union member may not necessarily be in favor of higher pensions for more senior members. He may not favor a tenure system that would deny him merit pay in favor of giving larger bonuses to older teachers. In that instance, however, he would nonetheless be forced to support collective bargaining on the view that somehow this speech redounds to his benefit. Chief Justice Roberts recognized that there are some anomalies that may arise in terms of how the court administers the distinction between chargeable expenses and non-chargeable expenses. For example, consider again a teacher's union. Let's say the teacher's union was advocating on Medicaid reimbursement rates, something that may affect broader union structures and unionization within the state. Clearly, that wouldn't be chargeable for teachers because it has very little to do directly with their own occupations and with their workplace conditions and their own pay. Nonetheless, that would, at least under the state of Illinois' argument here, be chargeable with respect to the home workers union that's at issue here. So you have this anomalous situation where the same core political speech regarding Medicaid reimbursement rates would be something that one worker could be forced to pay for and another worker would not be forced to pay for. Now, I think that influenced quite a bit what may have been the most surprising concession of the oral argument. And that was something that Solicitor General Virilio said. The federal government came into this case with a very strong argument in support of the state of the labor union here, arguing that the federal government and that state governments have a strong interest in being able to manage their workforces and having flexibility in being able to do that. It really asked the court not to impose any type of limitations on that power under the view that that would be inconsistent with the ability of government to function effectively. Solicitor General Verrilli, however, backed away from that very strong point of view somewhat in his oral argument. He conceded, I think based on the chief's questions to Paul Smith representing the state, that something like Medicaid, where you would have this Medicaid reimbursement rates, where you might have this type of anomalous situation, maybe that would fall on the impermissible side of the line. In other words, the First Amendment wouldn't allow a labor union to charge any worker for that kind of speech. Well, it strikes me that this is a very major concession because the federal government has now backed away from its absolutist positions and is now willing to play around with the intricacies and where it is exactly that the line might be drawn. And if you're drawing a line that close to workers' interests, in this instance, what it is they're being paid, what their wages are, it really does throw into question this entire superstructure of the law. In other words, ABUD. The court also questioned what the government's compelling interest really is here. Paul Smith and the Solicitor General were very vague on that point. As Justice Alito pointed out, there are no fair share fees in the federal government. For example, among Border Patrol agents, they get to choose whether or not they wish to support a labor union. The best the Solicitor General could say in response to that was that that's the federal government's choice, that they've decided not to require that type of support as a condition of employment, but that other states have chosen otherwise. But strict scrutiny under the First Amendment requires a compelling government interest. In other words, what the government is doing that abridges somebody's First Amendment rights must be necessary to the government's interest. And in this case, there's some doubt as to that necessity. When the government, as the Solicitor General conceded, doesn't need to do that as part of managing its workforce. Indeed, Justices Scalia and Alito cast doubt as to whether the government has any serious and concrete interest here at all, other than promoting unions for political reasons. As Justice Alito pointed out, here in Illinois, the initial executive order that rendered these workers state workers for purposes of unionization was signed by Governor Blagojevich shortly after his election. His largest donors, were a group of public worker unions, and this was really their chief issue going into the election. And so there's some reason to believe that the underlying motivation here may be more political than it may be than it may have anything to do with workplace management. Similarly, Justice Kennedy doubted that the union speech of this sort, even when it regards things like collective bargaining, really is kind of the baseline that the court should expect in terms of First Amendment rights. As he put it, forcing supportive unions actually may distort the speech that's going on with respect to government policies. Now, in response to this, the Solicitor General and Paul Smith played up the effect of stare decisis, that is, the reliance interest and the weight that state governments, as well as labor unions, have placed on the Abood decision. They've relied on it for many years. They've signed many agreements that relate to it. That's something that Justice Breyer, in particular, had a lot of questions about, as well as Justice Kagan. But before we get to that, I think, you know, at the end of the argument, you really have a split among the court. You've got three justices, including the Chief Justice, who seemed very wary and very dubious of the whole idea of a boot, the idea that government workers need someone to speak on core political issues on their behalf, the idea that they can be forced to support speech that not only might they disagree with, but isn't necessarily even in their interest, based on the idea that somebody, be it a state official or a union official, has decided that it's properly in their interest and that they therefore have to pay a fair share fee. So you've got the Chief Justice, Justice Alito, and Justice Kennedy very wary of this. You have Justice Kennedy in particular very wary that workers' core First Amendment rights, the rights to talk about the size of government, and really the course of our nation, these democratic issues, that they can be forced to pay for somebody else's speech on these very core political issues. And then on the other side, you've got Justices Kagan, Breyer, and Justice Ginsburg wondering, well, why shouldn't the government get to do what a private sector gets to do and work with the labor union to resolve its labor management issues? And why shouldn't a government get to, as part of that, deal with a single union and force all of its workers to select that union, to work with that union as their exclusive representative? It promotes labor peace, it promotes stability, and that's the sort of choice that's traditionally, at least for the past 40 or so years, been left to state governments. And then in the middle, oddly enough, you have Justice Scalia. Now, Justice Scalia has taken out two sharply divergent views. On the one hand, in previous cases, he's recognized that forced support of a labor union does burden key First Amendment rights. On the other hand, he's also recognized that unions typically have a duty of fair representation for all the workers whom they represent. So a worker can't, for example, say that when it's going into a collective bargaining session, that it wants to increase wages 10% for those workers who've chosen to join it, but to reduce wages for workers who only pay fair share fees but decline to actually join the union. Instead, it must represent them all, if not equally, then at least in some sort of fair manner. He's also, in a somewhat different context, taken a very critical view of the court's views regarding or the court's decisions regarding the free speech or the ability of government officials to hire and fire public employees based on their political interests. As Justice Scalia has written, political patronage is something that goes back decades or centuries even in American life, And it's something that the Supreme Court has only recently taken a dim view of. And so there's this thought that, well, if an official, under Justice Scalia's view of the First Amendment, could hire or fire an employee based on his support of the Democrat or the Republican Party, why couldn't an official do that based on whether or not the official supports a labor union? So I think the first question you have coming out of oral argument is, which way does Justice Scalia go? Well, we've seen something like this before, where Justice Scalia has kind of come down on both sides of the oral argument. And make no mistake, in this case, he did have tough questions for both sides. But I think what pushes him onto the side with Justice Alito and Justice Kennedy and the Chief is that in this instance, he's joined in the court's decisions trying to draw this line between chargeable and non-chargeable expenses. And I think what he's come to realize over the years is that this is what Justice Scalia would call a very flabby test. It's proven very difficult to decide which expenses fall onto which side of the line. Indeed, as I described in this argument, the solicitor general even had a difficult time saying which expenses fall where. Now, in Justice Scalia's view, they could refine this test more and they could get another set of cases and they could decide them in different ways. And then other courts could decide things differently. And that's how things would continue. And it would basically be a question of political judgment of the courts that decide these cases. That's not workable, it's flabby, and it doesn't provide a good principle of decision. I think in Justice Scalia's view, he likes neat lines, he likes administrable lines. And I think his view may well be that the court should stop trying to police a line that at best is quite faint. Second, the rationale here of Abood, at least, and I think as the facts in this case particularly demonstrate, the rationale of Abood, it goes well beyond just public employment. The idea is that it's easier for the government to deal with things when people who wish to speak with it are organized in some fashion, whether they're talking about wages or something else. In this instance, it's people who receive Medicaid benefits. Well, why wouldn't it be the patients themselves who are the direct beneficiaries? Why couldn't the government be able to organize them? Why couldn't it be doctors who accept Medicaid patients? Why couldn't it be lawyers who sometimes represent the indigent and are paid by the state for doing so? The rationale of Abood contains within itself no limiting principle. So far, it's only been applied to people who were expressly state employees, but this case in particular shows that that's a very malleable concept. The workers at issue here aren't hired or fired by the state. They merely receive subsidies from it. Now, if they could be covered by Abood, presumably anyone could be, and nothing in Abood seems directly to prevent that. The third thing, and something that came out of oral argument, I think is made very clear in the briefs, is that this duty of fair representation that Justice Scalia has relied on in other cases is somewhat illusory. Yes, sure, in a nominal sense, a labor union can't try and undermine the pay of workers who choose not to join it, but only to pay fair share fees. But on the other hand, as Justice Alito's hypothetical regarding a young worker joining a teacher's union illustrates, different workers may have different interests. A particular worker who favors limited government may not be in favor of across-the-board raises. A young worker who takes his job very seriously and would like to be paid more based on the amount of effort he puts into it may not favor a tenure system. A younger worker who's concerned about his own pay over the next several years may not be in favor of a generous pension system when that's going to squeeze the amount of money that's available for wages. All of these points came out, and they're points that I think Justice Scalia understands and has internalized. Now, if that's the case, that means that there may well be four votes, just among the justices who spoke today, to overturn Abood. And there's some reason to believe, based on his prior jurisprudence, that Justice Thomas may feel that way as well. The second question we have coming out of oral argument is about the Chief. The Chief, of course, is an incrementalist. Is the Chief willing to decide a case like this broadly? Or is he going to find it more attractive to look at this narrow issue, just regarding these types of workers here who aren't directly managed or supervised by the state? Now, his questions did not suggest that he's willing to take or eager to take a narrow view of this. He was very focused on what it is, where this money comes from, what are the state decisions that govern this money? Isn't this really just another government program? And aren't these collective bargaining topics, aren't these just questions about how the government spends money and the size of government and core political questions? So the Chief's question suggests that he's not necessarily looking at the narrow implications of this. And, of course, he's also well aware, and this, again, is something that came out, I think, in some of his questioning, that a lot of the factual questions here are very close. A state could designate people slightly differently. It may open them up even while not managing them. It may designate them state workers for other things. The facts could be subtly different. If the court does decide narrowly, labor unions and states that support them will try and work around whatever it is that it's decided. So a narrow decision risks that. And the third question is going to be, what's the role of stare decisis? Well, that's something that a lot of the justices on the left were interested in. It's hard to tell that there was any conclusive answer on this point from the oral argument. I think the conservative justices seem largely uninterested in the question. I think that's actually fair, though. This would be a very incremental decision. The upshot of a decision that overturns Abood would merely mean that workers who don't want to don't have to pay a labor union, at least public workers. It wouldn't do anything more than that. The unions would still exist, and the states could still bargain with them. In fact, the unions would still be exclusive representatives for workers. The free rider idea is massively overblown. Two dozen states have right to work laws, and federal employees get to choose whether or not to join or support a labor union in those states. That's also true for the federal government and federal government employees. We've seen how this works, and frankly, the world's going to keep turning, and it's not going to blow up state labor markets. So stare decisis, at least in this instance, is not something that would necessarily will sway the court one way or the other. So what's the bottom line? I think the court is very skeptical that the state is trying to do anything else here than provide political payback, generous payback, to labor unions, and that state's actual interest in coercing and compelling speech from its employees is somewhat limited. There are at least 3 or 4 votes and possibly 5 to reconsider Abood. And if that's the case, and if that's the way this case is decided, it would be a major landmark in both First Amendment law and labor law. And I think with that, I'm ready and happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much. We're speaking, of course, with Andrew Grossman. We're now going to open the floor to questions from the audience. In a moment, we should all hear that the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Mr. Grossman, our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller. We have just one question, and then our lines are open. So again, press the star button and then the pound button to indicate you have a question. Let's take our first question.
Roland, Constitution.org. Just what kind of domestic workers are involved in this case, and to what kinds might a precedent apply? I think of a domestic worker as an individual contractor that I, as a householder, hire to maybe clean my house. And I would hate to see a situation like I encountered when I was going to college, of having the Chicago's Plumbers Union threatened to picket my frat house because us frat brothers made our own plumbing repairs.
Well, I think your intuition is exactly right. The type of workers that you're talking about in these two state programs are home care workers. They provide personal health care services to people who are severely disabled. That can include some amount of cleaning. It can include putting away groceries. It can include picking up prescriptions. It can include dealing with medical equipment. It's generally services that don't rise to the level of nursing, but may include things like administering medications, doing laundry, and so on. Now, the interesting point here, the factual point, is that these workers are not hired by the state. They're not fired by the state. On a day-to-day basis, they're not managed by the state. They're not evaluated by the state. All the state does here is to provide them subsidies. And the real beneficiary, of course, is not really the worker. And many of these workers are just family members, and the subsidies they get help to offset the massive cost of care that's borne by their disabled or injured relatives for whom they're caring. So these people really don't have much in the way of relation to the state. It's just purely a nominal worker relationship, the only purpose of which is to enable them to be forcibly organized, as in this instance. And it's something that we've seen not merely with these types of home care workers. We've seen it in some states with daycare workers, sometimes with family members or even grandparents who are caring for small children. We've seen it with cleaning staff. There have been attempts to unionize household cleaners and the like by, again, naming the states or naming the locality as their employer of record. just as basically a legal fiction. So that's something that is definitely an issue in this case, and whether the court rules broadly or narrowly, if it does decide for the plaintiffs, it will probably cast a doubt on that type of relationship.
Once again, if you have a question, we've got one question pending now. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Ed Benbrook, calling from Sacramento. Great job on the Cato brief if you worked with David on that. Is the opportunity there, you think, for five justices to take up the theory presented by Justice Alito and Knox as a way not to go all the way of overruling Abood, but saying that the opt-out regime is a violation of the First Amendment?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I couldn't hear the question.
Sorry, yeah. I was asking if there's an opportunity in this case, if five judges aren't prepared to overrule Abood to adopt the regime proposed by Justice Alito and Knox to the effect that mandatory opt-in or requiring workers to opt out is a violation of the First Amendment, and therefore saying that they must opt in order to have their dues go to certain purposes.
Right. I think in this case, the opt-in / opt-out distinction isn't really at issue. And in any case, the court has never considered, the court has always assumed that workers, public workers, since Abood, can be compelled to pay these sort of fair share payments, even if they don't join the labor union. And so there really wouldn't be anything for them to opt into because that would already be deducted from their pay packets by the state in this instance. Now, where Knox may well factor in is that Knox cast a lot of doubt on this free rider rationale, recognizing that in no other instance do the courts consider the possibility of free riders to justify infringement of people's First Amendment rights. So to the extent that Knox is going to be relevant here, I think it's going to serve as precedent in that sense that if the government, you know, is concerned about managing its workforce, it has lots of ways of doing that, and it doesn't necessarily need to resort to forcing everybody to support financially a labor union. But in particular, in this instance, there were several questions regarding pay. The attorney for the state and for the labor union suggested that the labor union was essential to determining what it was that state workers actually wanted. And it turns out, surprise, that what they wanted, some of them at least, was more money. They wanted higher wages. Now, of course, the state could probably figure that out for itself. It could survey its members and poll them. It could hire a public, a public polling firm to determine what it is that they like. It could talk to them. Or it could simply guess that workers who are unhappy may well wish to be paid more money. Ditto with training programs, ditto with benefits, and so on down the line. And Knox suggests that a government really has to seriously think about those alternatives before it can even consider abridging somebody's First Amendment rights by forcing them to pay for speech that they might not, in fact, agree with.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open at this point in time. Let me take advantage of that opportunity to talk about our calendar coming up for Teleforum conference calls tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We have another Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum where we'll be talking about the Paroline versus U.S. case. That's a proximate cause and restitution case that concerns a child pornography matter. Then on Thursday at 1 p.m., we'll be talking about potential reform of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And then Friday at 2 p.m., we'll be talking to Clark Forsyth about his book, Abuse of Discretion. For a more complete calendar and extending on into next week, you can obviously check the Federal Society's website. But today, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending now. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Glenn Taubman from the National Right to Work Foundation. Good job, Andrew, in summarizing what happened today. I was there in the courthouse, and I thought your summary was very good. So my question is, do you detect any or do you feel any irony and or detect any hypocrisy by the justices like Kagan and Breyer, who are suddenly all interested in federalism and the idea that every state should be able to decide this issue on its own, when they're very happy to federalize issues like gay marriage and abortions and things like that? But suddenly I heard more about federalism from the left today than I think I've ever heard in my life. So I wonder if you could comment on that.
Thanks, Glenn. First, let me say that the National Right to Work Foundation should be very proud of its advocates, in this case, Bill Messenger, who did a wonderful job presenting the case oral arguments, as well as in briefing it. As to the question regarding federalism's fair weather friends, look, this isn't unusual. We've seen this in a number of cases. When there's a challenge to something that some states are doing that may well violate constitutional rights, you see oftentimes people who are generally not friends of federalism coming out of the woodwork to argue that different states should be allowed to take different approaches. Now, the interesting thing is, whichever way this case comes out, states are going to be allowed to take different approaches. If a state wants to work with a labor union and wants to appoint a labor union as an exclusive representative, no matter which way this case comes out, states are going to be able to do that. If a state wants to consult a labor union in terms of putting together its pay packages, it can do that. If it wants to bargain with the labor union, it can do that. The only limitation would be that it simply couldn't force its employees to financially support that labor union speech if they disagree with it. So you're really talking about, in this instance, a very narrow position. Really, there is no question at this point that the First Amendment applies equally no matter what state you're in. And you'd think that that's something that the folks on the justices on the left side of the court, as well as on the right side of the court, would agree with and would recognize that if you're talking about core political speech, it's protected whether you're in Massachusetts or whether you're in Texas, whether you're in California, or in this case, whether you're in Illinois. So I think the appeals to federalism certainly do ring hollow in this instance.
Once again, we're speaking with Andrew Grossman. If you have a question, we only have one question pending. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Chris Garvey here. I was gratified to hear that the justices were taking the idea that if there was any other means demonstrated to deal with the First Amendment question, then the First Amendment restriction should be subject to strict scrutiny. Is that the term, or not? And two aspects of that question. Could you elaborate on what that means, and then say which other amendments the court has given a similar standard to?
Well, first of all, in terms of First Amendment, what standard applies? There actually was some confusion on this question prior to the court's decision in Knox. Prior to Knox, all First Amendment cases, just about, except for labor union cases and some political cases involving political speech, always got strict scrutiny. In other words, the government has to have just the utmost compelling interest, and the way that it chooses to achieve that interest needs to be narrowly tailored, which would mean that if there's some way that is less intrusive of people's rights, of its citizens' rights, the government has to explore those options and it has to engage in what the court's called narrow tailoring. Knox made clear that for labor union membership, for coercing people to either join a union or to financially support a union, that's subject to the same standard. The court there called it exacting scrutiny, but the idea is still the same, that the government has to have a compelling interest and that it has to, its means have to be narrowly tailored to that interest. And in Knox, the court held that forcing people who chose not to join a labor union to make a payment to fund the labor union's political expenditures, which they then potentially could get refunded to them at some point in the future, but that wasn't narrowly tailored. that the state and that the labor union could go about that through an opt-out, through an opt-in regime rather than an opt-out regime, could do that in a way that was less infringing of dissenting workers' rights. Now, if you apply that in a straightforward manner here, there are obviously lots of ways that a state like Illinois could figure out what it is that its workers want, how it is that it might be able, that the state might be able to retain those workers, how they need to be trained, and so on. As for where else this kind of strict scrutiny concept applies, well, at this point you're talking about the waterfront of First Amendment protected activity. Probably the most prominent exception at this point are political contributions. In other words, contributions that a person may make or that an organization may make to a political candidate or to a political party. Those are at issue to some extent in another case that's pending right now called McCutcheon v. SEC. And it's certainly possible that the court may adopt that same standard that applies to every other First Amendment issue in that case. We may well see that before the end of the term.
Let me make another call for questions now. Our lines are completely open. If you have a question for Andrew Grossman, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Last call for questions, star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question. If not, Andrew, we still have a few minutes left. Do you want to take a minute and express, just wrap up and give us your concluding remarks?
Sure. I think the big takeaway, the two big takeaways from oral arguments today are, first, that the court really is thinking about these major and very basic issues. It's willing to go back to key First Amendment doctrines and is not willing to hang its hat on the fact that it may have made a questionable decision 30-some-odd years ago. And the second is that there really was a lot of skepticism on the court for the state of Illinois' motivations in declaring these workers to be employees of the state only for purposes of collective bargaining and unionization and for no other purpose whatsoever. And when you look at it, when you look at the facts, I think the reason for that skepticism becomes clear. You have politicians in the state who are supported by unions who find, in their political endeavors that they wind up working a lot with labor unions. Labor unions, of course, have a very large political voice. And a lot of these, I think you see that in the distribution of states, and there are about a dozen or so now, that have adopted these types of programs regarding home care workers. They tend to be states that have Democratic governors, usually Democratic legislators, and they usually tend to be states where there's a very strong union presence, where the unions are heavily involved in electoral politics. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong with a labor union being involved in electoral politics, no more so than any other organization. But it does certainly lead to skepticism that what the state is doing here is trying to benefit its employees or even benefit itself in terms of the management of its workers. And that's further undercut by the idea that so many other states and so many other businesses manage their workers and have good workplace relations and don't have a lot of turnover, even though they don't have a labor union to represent their employees. So if the court looks at those facts and it's appropriately skeptical, it's going to come out in this case, and I think that's most likely, on the side of the plaintiffs. Whether it goes large or whether it tries to address this more narrowly is still up in the air, but I think we have reason to believe, as I said, that the court is really willing to go back to First Amendment fundamentals here. And if it does so, Abood may not be long for this world. And that would be, albeit, while it would be an incremental change, it would still be a monumental victory for public workers' First Amendment rights.
Well, I want to thank, on behalf of the Federalist Society, Andrew Grossman, very much, not just for your time this afternoon, but for making the trip into Washington this morning in foul weather to attend the oral argument. We certainly appreciate your insights, and thank you for being here. To our audience, I want to thank you for your attendance today and your participation as well. And a reminder that we'll hope you will join tomorrow's Courthouse Steps Teleforum conference call at 3 p.m., but until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.